nuclear winter from the war between the United States and Russia and China would probably get you within about 1% of what happened to the dinosaurs. You've probably all heard politicians say a nuclear war cannot be won and should never be fought. They all say that, but do they understand it? Do they actually mean that? Or is that just lip service?
That's Brian Toon, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Brian Toon on dinosaurs, extinctions, and nuclear war. Millions of years ago, a huge asteroid hit what is now the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. The global forests and grasslands burned. The smoke from the resulting fires marks one of the greatest extinctions in Earth's history, including not just dinosaurs, but also fish, plankton, and plants. Today, a war with just a few of the world's thousands of nuclear weapons targeted on densely populated cities could plunge Earth into the same types of conditions that the dinosaurs experienced. A war involving Russia, NATO, and the United States could kill billions of people. And what is the U.S. doing? It is upgrading and modernizing all components of its nuclear weapons arsenal at a cost of over $1 trillion. With the possibility of nuclear war, humans may end up like the dinosaurs. Our guest today is Brian Toon. He's Professor Emeritus in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences and the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's an award-winning scholar and co-author of Earth in Flames. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado in late August. And now, Brian Toon.
Thank you for inviting me to talk to you. So today, I'm going to tell you about the extinction of the dinosaurs and what might happen to you in a nuclear war. So you might think this is odd, and what have these things got to do with each other? So one of the thoughts I want to leave you with is that they seem to have a common potential cause. 66 million years ago, an asteroid about as big as Mount Everest smacked into the Yucatan Peninsula at about 20 times the velocity of the fastest rifle bullet, releasing an energy of about 100,000 million tons of TNT, far larger than any nuclear arsenal we have. Following that, everything on the surface of the Earth burned and caught fire. The smoke from that and the fires are what caused the extinctions. How about a nuclear winter? How about a nuclear war? In a nuclear war, there will be thousands of burning cities across the globe. Those cities burning would, of course, kill many people who live in the cities, but the smoke would go into the upper atmosphere, spread across the Earth, black out the sun, and start freezing temperatures at mid-latitudes, continuing on for years, which would lead to global starvation. We estimate that by the end of the second year, a war between the United States, Russia, and China would leave about 5% of the human population in the United States, Canada, Russia, China, Middle East, and Europe. Okay, so what do we know about extinctions? This comes from a bunch of geologists who like to go around and hack at rocks and look at the edges of cliffs. And when you look at the side of a cliff face, well, you often see layers of rocks. And so the geologists will go and look at those layers of rocks and the fossils that are in them. And they can tell how old they are from that. And so what they have noticed is that sometimes the fossils change. So you have to think about the organization of living organisms. So the most restrictive thing is a species. So we're all Homo sapiens. The next thing up is a genus. We're the only species in our genus, but there used to be other species. not that long ago, actually, of Neanderthals, Denisovians, and Florenzians. There were quite a few homos on the planet not that long ago. We're in the family of great apes with gorillas. So the average lifetime of a mammal species on the Earth is about 1 million years. So you can't really do extinctions very easily with species because they don't last very long, which doesn't bode well for us. We've already been around 200,000 years. We may not make it that much longer. Okay, so what the geologists do is they look at the extinction rate. How many families disappear in 1 million years? And so you can see there's a constant background level of extinctions, about 5 families per 1 million years. But there are occasionally times when 10 to 20 families go extinct in a smaller time frame. There's one of them about 400 and 500 million years ago, another one around 400 million. This is a really big one, about 250. This is where the dinosaurs arose after this extinction. So they are the product of an extinction. And they took over the world at this extinction. Mammals arose at the same time. So our ancestors have been on the planet as long as the dinosaurs, more than 100 million years. This is the event 66 million years ago when the dinosaurs became extinct and the mammals first really took over control. So you're here because of an accident of a rock hitting the planet. So it's thought that about 95% of the species on the planet died in this event. So as far as we know, these extinctions here were caused by volcanic activity, pumping up carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. On the other hand, the extinction 66 million years ago, there's quite a bit of material left to know about that one, and that killed about 75% of the species on the planet. Here's another one. This one is caused by us. And so you probably know that people are taking over the Earth. On the average person has about 2 football fields of land to have your house on, grow your crops on, have your forests and deserts and things like that on. You've got 2 football fields shared with everybody else on the planet. So we're pushing all the other animals off, like the elephants and other creatures are dying out. So this appears to be a mass extinction that we're in the middle of here. Okay, so these mass extinctions, we'd like to know more about them. This extinction was much more than the dinosaurs. 75% of the species on the planet died. It wasn't just dinosaurs, it was 94% of the mammals. There were extinctions in the oceans of lots of fish and plankton and things like that. It's very unlikely they caught the flu. So what did cause the extinction? So Harold Urey, who was a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, suggested that extinctions would occur because of asteroids hitting the planet, because he thought the timing of extinctions was about the same as the timing of big asteroids hitting the planet. Nobody paid any attention to this idea. There was a little thin strata here that you could put your hand on where the dinosaur extinction happened. Of course, this wasn't marked by dinosaur bones sticking out because they're very rare. It was marked by plankton and things like that, which are very numerous and easy to find. There is a constant rain of stuff coming into the Earth's atmosphere. There's about 40 tons of micrometeorites, tiny little meteorites, coming into the Earth every day. They're hitting the roof of this building. If you wanted to, you could go drag magnets on it, and you might find a few of them. So they knew about this, and they figured, well, we can time how long it took to put this little layer down. And they were going to do it by seeing how much micrometeorites were there. Micrometeorites come from space on undifferentiated asteroids. On the Earth, the core of the Earth formed early in its history, and iridium went to the core along with iron. So it's depleted in the crust of the Earth. But it's very common in asteroids. So you could look for iridium, an element, and tell how many asteroids were in a thin layer. So they did that, and they discovered to their surprise that the layer was almost entirely asteroid. And from the amount of iridium, they could tell the size of the asteroid, which is about the size of Mount Everest, about 10 kilometers in diameter. And it probably hit, as I said, at about 20 times the speed of the fastest bullet. It took quite a while, a decade or so, to find the crater. People thought the crater may have never been found because of C4 spreading and loss, but in fact it hit in the Yucatan Peninsula, which at the time was underwater. So when the asteroid, which is about 500 cubic kilometers of material, hit Mexico, there was such a strong shock wave that it vaporized the asteroid and about an equal mass of Mexico. This vapor, rock vapor, probably spread 1,000 kilometers above the Earth. We saw this happen on Jupiter, spread to huge heights, spread out because it was a gas of rock, and as it cooled, it condensed and formed spheres. And these things re-entered the atmosphere as little shooting stars. So you've probably all seen shooting stars in a shooting star storm. You might see one a minute. In this case, there are 10,000 shooting stars on the ground, where it's preserved in the geological layers, 10,000 shooting stars still preserved per square centimeter, you know, twice that much per square inch or something. That's a lot. So it wasn't just a few things flashing through the sky. It was a whole swarm of them. The most surprising thing in this layer is soot. So elemental carbon, black carbon, soot, is you see it around your fireplace. You've got a wood-burning fireplace. It all turns back to black at the edges. That's what this is. And the stuff that's found in this layer looks exactly the same as what you see from forest fires today. There's a lot of this stuff in the boundary layer, about 50,000 million tons of soot. You had to burn everything on the surface of the planet to create that much soot. So as far as we can tell, everything on the surface caught fire. What probably did happen looks like what you see in a fire in a forest, an intense fire. The sky is a glowing red gas. And of course, everything catches fire from the glow from the air. So this sand-sized spheres probably started everything on fire. How did they do that? When they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, they came in just like shooting stars. You've seen the trail behind shooting stars. That's because of friction with the air, and the shooting star that's coming in at huge velocities gets very hot and vaporizes and leaves behind a hot trail of vaporized rock. Well, these things from the asteroid weren't coming in quite that fast, so they didn't vaporize, but they did heat up the upper atmosphere. So the air above about 60 kilometers or so was probably at about 2,000 degrees centigrade, 3,000 Fahrenheit or something like that, 2,000 degrees centigrade. That would be like standing in front of a red hot sheet of lava if you were exposed to that. It's not like point source. The sun is a point source. There are shadows. The whole sky here is glowing red. There are no shadows. So there's no way that a dinosaur could get away from this. So the dinosaurs are not the whole story. There's lots of other land creatures there. Probably many of them died the same way, not being able to hide from these global fires. But there's also a mass extinction in the oceans. Obviously, the oceans didn't catch on fire. So what happened there? The extinction in the oceans was caused because the lights went out. All this smoke from all these global fires in the stratosphere reduced light levels to 100 millionth of what we normally see. So this is kind of a surprising thing about human beings is your eyes are logarithmic. You can actually see light levels 100 millionth down. If you go out on a moonless night, the light levels are around 100 millionth of normal. Cameras are not logarithmic, they're linear. They can't see once you get just a few percent of light. And photosynthesis is not logarithmic. Photosynthesis only works at light levels above about 1% of normal. So that's what happened is all that smoke blotted out the sun, and the photosynthesis stopped, and then everything died in the oceans. How did we survive? How did our ancestors survive this? So there's some avian dinosaurs that made it through. They probably were like parrots, some of whom live in termite mounds. Our ancestors at the time were like little mice. You know, we were the kings of the small world and the dinosaurs were the kings of the big world. We were not out-competing the dinosaurs. We've been around for 100 million years with them. We weren't getting anywhere. And this asteroid killed the dinosaurs, and we took over. Dale Russell, who was at the Canadian Natural History Museum, made a statue of what he thought would be here without the asteroid collision. So he envisioned that there was a dinosaur, they're in a group called Troodons. You see a lot of these as velociraptors in dinosaur movies. They're little small things running around viciously attacking stuff. The Troodons are actually about as big as a turkey. At any rate, he thought this was about the smartest dinosaur based on the size of his brain. So he thought it was about as smart as an ostrich or an armadillo. Armadillos are not too bright to get run over by cars all the time and get made into purses. But he thought that over time that they would evolve to have a big brain, and they would still retain about three fingers, and he thought that they would develop a belly button so that they could have live birth. And so possibly this is who would be here now if it hadn't been for this event. So let's turn our attention now to nuclear wars. Nuclear weapons were developed in the Second World War. In 1945, at the end of the war, there were a couple of weapons that had been dropped in Hiroshima and almost none left. By the mid-1960s is when I graduated from high school, 1965, there were about 40,000 on the planet, 30,000 of them in the United States, and maybe 10,000 in Russia. And by 1985, there were 65,000 nuclear weapons on the planet, 40,000 in Russia, and we were down to 25,000 then. Right now, there are more than 10,000 left, and in the arsenals of both Russia and the United States, each of them have about 4,000. 2,000 of these are deployed, ready to be used. Okay, so something obviously happened here in around 1985 to cause this big build-down. So at this time, there were 60,000 nuclear weapons on the planet. There are only 500 cities between Russia and the United States, 300 in the United States with more than 100,000 people, bigger than Boulder. Boulder's about 100,000. 300 cities. There's only 200 cities that big in Russia. Russia's got the population of about Japan. That's half the population of the United States, even though it's the biggest country in Asia and Europe and in the world. At any rate, if you take 60,600 and divide by 5, you know, that's like more than 100 weapons on each tiny little town. You only need one weapon to destroy a town like Boulder. How many weapons are aimed at Boulder? Well, right now, we have 2,000 each, 4,000 total weapons. 8 nuclear weapons could be used to attack every city in Russia and the U.S. with more than 100,000 people with 8 nuclear weapons. In most towns the size of Boulder, there's nothing worth attacking with 8 nuclear weapons, let alone 1 nuclear weapon. But it's easy to find out where the weapons are aimed at Boulder. There are weapons aimed at you right now. There's plenty of weapons going around here to destroy all the cities in Russia and the U.S. Okay, so what happened here is that Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev decided they'd had enough. So for those of you who remember the Reagan administration, he had proposed Star Wars as a golden dome, which is what Trump is now proposing, to protect us from missile attacks. And so he appeared to be a dangerous president who might drag us into a war. So here's what Gorbachev and Reagan said about that peak. They said, models, climate models made by Russian and American scientists showed that a nuclear war would result in a nuclear winter that would be extremely destructive to all life on Earth. The knowledge of that was a great stimulus to us, to people of honor and morality, to act in that situation. A great many reputable scientists are telling us that such a war could just end up in no victory for anyone because we would wipe out the Earth as we know it. And if you think back to natural calamities, back in the last century in the 1800s, volcanoes, We saw the weather so change that there was snow in July in many temperate countries, and they called it the year in which there was no summer. Now, if one volcano can do that, what are we talking about with the whole nuclear exchange? The nuclear winter that scientists have been talking about, it's possible. So Reagan actually wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons, and he and Gorbachev actually agreed to get rid of them, but they were prevented by their advisors from doing so. But they did start a build-down of nuclear weapons. And that build-down of nuclear weapons has continued ever since then. Every American president since then and every Russian leader since then has reduced nuclear weapons until the Biden administration. And so this build-down has stopped. The agreement that Reagan and Gorbachev put in place was to eliminate short-range nuclear missiles in Europe, which were a great threat to Europe, obviously. Donald Trump eliminated that treaty in his first term. So we only have one treaty left. It expires in February of next year. That's limiting nuclear armaments. And the Obama administration, to get a treaty that really was not of much value, he agreed to give the military and the Department of Energy $1 trillion to build up nuclear weapons. So there's a huge nuclear weapon refurbishment going on in the United States involving new plutonium for nuclear weapons and a whole bunch of other things. The Russians are doing the same thing. In fact, the Russians violated the treaty, which is why Trump walked away from it, by producing missiles that could still attack Europe, and they have 1,000 of those. At any rate, everybody has been following this downward path, and we've leveled off now. However, there is hope for something to happen here, because Donald Trump doesn't like all this money being wasted on nuclear weapons. He didn't know much about nuclear weapons in his first term. Someone told him they were useless. And he said, well, why are we putting all this money into nuclear weapons? So if we can ever solve the Ukrainian problem, there's some hope that Putin and Trump can reach an agreement to eliminate more of these weapons. There are other countries also have nuclear weapons. So from the 1970s up until recently, the number of these was pretty flat, around a few hundred weapons in France and the United Kingdom and China, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. But right now, there's a big expansion going on. So when Gorbachev and Reagan reached their agreement, everybody stopped building them. But now they're starting to build them again. So China is ramping up its arsenals so that they're similar to those in the U.S. and Russia. They're around 500 now. North Korea's got an arsenal. No one knows how big it is, but it's probably around 50. And India and Pakistan have weapons that are thought to be around 150 or so each. So there's lots of weapons out there in other countries, which makes this a political nightmare because they all have different interests. This was something that worried Kennedy. In the 60s, he thought there would be dozens of nuclear states by now, which there are not, but it is expanding. So what happens if a nuclear explosion occurs? So if you look at pictures of Hiroshima after the bomb fell, there are some standing concrete structures, but most of the area for about a mile around that just looked like burned out rubble. And that's not from the shockwave from the bomb. It's from a fire that started in all the wooden buildings there. The same thing is true of Nagasaki. That was how the Second World War ended. The United States firebombed 60 Japanese cities, as well as Hamburg and Dresden and a couple other places in Europe. And the war ended. So it's a fire that happened. And we know this happened because the Japanese took pictures of it. There are pictures of the firestorm, which started about 3 hours after the bomb fell. And in the museum there, there's a stucco wall that has black stripes of radioactive soot from a black rain that fell on Hiroshima after this event. There's also pictures from airplanes that flew over a little bit after the explosion, and they took pictures of the smoke cloud. So this is a big thunderstorm. It was a big thunderstorm. These are called pyrocumulus or pyro-CBs. They're happening in fires in Canada now. There was one in British Columbia in 2017. that was about as tall as this one. There's another one in Australia in 2020 that was about as big as this one. This one was above the altitude of the airplane. Guess that this is in the lower stratosphere, probably somewhere around 16 kilometers above the ground. Why does this matter? If you have a normal forest fire, like the ones from Canada and stuff we're suffering from in the last few years, the smoke stays in the lower atmosphere where we live, called the troposphere. And it just blows along, and after a week or two, it gets rained out when it hits a rainstorm. But if smoke goes into the stratosphere, it never rains. So how many of you have been in the stratosphere? Probably you've all been in the stratosphere. If you fly in a commercial airliner, they go in the stratosphere almost all the time when they're cruising. So you can all put your hands up. You've been in the stratosphere. It doesn't rain in the stratosphere. And so you put stuff in the stratosphere, it will stay there for years. So people have modeled this for an imaginary war between India and Pakistan. So in a war like this, of course, there's a lot of smoke generated from burning cities in India and Pakistan. And this imaginary war started in the computer on the 15th of May. By the 1st of June, the smoke has spread all the way across the northern hemisphere. And by a month, it spread deep into the southern hemisphere. And because it's black smoke, when the sun shines on it, it heats it, and the air rises. We've actually seen this happen in 2017 and 2020 for the first time after big fires put smoke in the stratosphere. The smoke rose up to 20 or 30 kilometers altitude. We could see it for a year with satellites. And we see numbers here like a tenth. That means a tenth of all the photons coming into the atmosphere are being absorbed by that black carbon or soot. So we can look at this in a little more detail, a little scarier detail. So this is a war between the United States and Russia and China. And we're looking here at what happens in Iowa and the Ukraine. We pick those two places because they're the breadbaskets of the U.S. and Russia and Europe. We want them to be able to grow food. So in January, in a normal year, it's cold, and so you're in winter, and the temperature is below freezing. And as spring comes along, it warms up, and by the middle of the summer, the minimum daily temperature, the lowest temperature of the day, is around 15 degrees centigrade, you know, which is a nice enough temperature. And then in the fall, it drops below freezing again, comes back up warm, and then it goes back down as cold. In this calculation, what happens is, when this war starts, the temperature immediately starts dropping. By the early fall, the temperatures are below freezing. All the next winter, they're below freezing. All the next summer, they're below freezing. All the winter after that, they're below freezing. It's only in the second summer after this war that you start to get a few days with the lowest daily temperature above freezing. You're not going to grow anything in this kind of a situation. The other thing that happens is a global ozone hole. So right now we have an ozone hole. If you make a map of where the ozone is, you see a little blue ring in the color diagrams people use, marking the ozone hole over Antarctica, which is still there and probably going to last till the middle of this century. When you do this calculation following the war, the ozone hole becomes global. This is not good, because ozone protects us from ultraviolet light. You wouldn't be able to walk outside of your house for very long with these kinds of ozone levels. We have no idea what this would do to crops and animals who can't go into houses, because we've never seen anything on the planet like this.
You're listening to Brian Toon on dinosaurs, extinctions, and nuclear war. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Okay, so we know a lot about agriculture. It's big money. There's all kinds of numerical models for agriculture that try to figure out what's going to happen to food if it gets warmer next year or colder next year. And so they've looked at this with a model that can look at the crops that are produced in every country in the world and ask what would happen to them if it got cold. Why is it going to get cold? Because the sunlight is all being absorbed in the stratosphere.